Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, renowned book critic and editor Donna Seaman discusses her new memoir, River of Books, A Life in Reading. This program originally took place December 16th, 2024, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Thank you all for being here tonight. Welcome to the American Writers Museum. We're very excited about tonight's program for a number of reasons. One, because there's a wonderful book that we get to talk about. And number two is the person that we're going to be talking to. Donna Seaman is the editor-in-chief at Booklist, where she has been working now for a period of time, where she started as an editorial assistant some years ago. She is the recipient of the Louis Shore Award for Excellence in Book Reviewing, the James Friend Memorial Award for Literary Criticism, and the Studs Terkel Humanities Service Award. Seaman has written for the Chicago Tribune and the LA Times and other publications. She's been a writer in residence for Columbia College Chicago, has taught at Northwestern and the University of Chicago. Her author interviews are collected in Writers on the Air, Conversations About Books, and she is the author of Identity Unknown, Rediscovering Seven American Women Artists, and of course, she lives here in Chicago. Now, more importantly than all of that for us is that Donna is a member of the original content leadership team of the American Writers Museum. So for many years, before this museum even existed as a physical entity, Donna was involved in conversations with a host of other people and a core team of advisors. And actually here tonight is one of the designers of this museum who worked with her. So Scott is back there. And so Donna has been integral to this process, and we'll talk a little bit about that later. But that is why we are so thrilled to be able to talk with Donna tonight about this amazing book. And this amazing book is River of Books, A Life in Reading by Donna Seaman. It is a wonderful memoir. It's actually a very different type of memoir. And to kind of kick things off, I was wondering if, Donna, you could explain how this is a memoir and how it's related to reading.
Thank you so much, Carrie. And thanks, everyone, for being here. And I do love being in this space. So this little book was an interesting project. I was invited to write it, which is such a pleasure. So it's part of a series called Ode Books, which is a series of books by book people about places devoted to books. That was the idea. And they were supposed to be these sort of small books, essay length. The first one was written by Paul Yamasaki from City Lights Bookstore in San Francisco, legendary bookseller. And then I was second. And I was sort of puzzled as to how to do this. How would I write about my passion for books? And as I always say, I can't write about what I do currently. Can't really write about Booklist. It's just too complicated. So I thought, well, how about I tell the story of how I got to where I am today? And that's what this is. Now, I had hoped that it would primarily be about books and that you would just get little glimpses of me in between. But the editors didn't like that. They wanted more personal stories. And you know, once you start telling stories about yourself, well, it's a great opportunity. So that was it. It's a life in books. So it's young Donna reading up till I find my place at Booklist.
Yeah. And so the title River of Books, you use a number of metaphors, this one specifically, to talk about books. And there was a short passage I asked if you could just read. And I think when you hear this, you really start to understand what the idea of a river of books means to someone's life.
Yes, thank you. So this is from the very beginning. Like rivers, books connect places near and far. Books and rivers contain and sustain lives. Books can be crystal clear or murky, serpentine or straight ahead, shallow or deep, slow flowing or tumultuous. Rivers and books carry the living and the dead, the past, present, and future. Rivers and books define and transform the terrain across which they flow and the people whose lives depend on them.
And I really loved the way you talk about reading throughout the book. And if you were a superhero, we would say that your superpower is reading. But one of the things about it is that this book is, it's beautifully written, and it is definitely something that anybody who loves to read is going to look at and say, wow, this is akin to my life. This is akin to that moment. I understand that because there was that book I read that time that changed how I perceived the world. And you do it in depth through a huge amount of books because you were such a voracious reader from the time you were young. But your ability to write this seems to have been driven partly by the other side of you, which was the person who was keeping track of everything you read. Unlike now, some of us are not as organized as you. But clearly, you mentioned in the book getting a diary at a young age, I forget how young, and then you kept journaling and tracking what you read and writing book reports for your father. So tell us about like how that happened and how it's been a part of your life for so long.
Yes. Oh, goodness. Who knows what temperament's about, why you're like that. I laugh about being organized. I'm organized in some ways and really chaotic in others.
Yes, I've seen your desk.
Yes, exactly. Thank you. But I always wanted to write. I mean, you know, when I was a little girl, I just fell in love with the whole idea of writing and writers. And so I always had little notebooks, and I was given, you know, one of those fancy little diaries with that locked, a little tiny lock and a little tiny key, which seemed way too fancy for me, but I used it nonetheless. But I felt very compelled to find out about books, to not only read books that, you know, maybe people gave me, but to search for books. And so I had sort of projects in mind, things I wanted to read. So I would make lists of books that I hoped to read. Then I would write about the books I did read. And, you know, I wrote about really everything to do with books, what I found out about writers. I became really a nerd about publishers because I noticed that there were certain publishers that published books I really liked. So all that just always was to the notebook and to keep journals and to write about what I thought about and questions I had and things like that. So that's been really a lifelong habit.
And this started as young as before junior high?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, in elementary school.
Yeah.
And you mentioned the book report. I had no memory of that, but I lost both my parents during the writing of this book. This book's shadowed by a lot of loss. So I had to clean out the house. My parents had lived in the same house for 50 years. And the house always looked very beautiful, but it turned out that every hidden space was crammed with stuff. It was astonishing. And I found all these boxes of papers in the attic, and I'm looking through them, and I'm like, what is this? And they were my father's papers. My mother sort of dominated in many ways. And I come across this box of papers from my childhood. Well, prior to that, I had been trying to remember when I read David Copperfield, because that was a favorite book of mine. And I kept thinking, I couldn't have been that young. Like, I went and got David Copperfield back out of the library, and I'm looking at it going, I could not have read this as a girl. This is ridiculous. And then I find this thing in my little girl handwriting, and it's a book report. And it turns out that I figured out that my parents were always trying to get me to put down the book and be social, like talk to people, go outside. And so it was a struggle. And my father thought, all right, she's just always reading. I am going to base her allowance on her writing book reports. Like, is she really reading these books? And why is she reading these books? And so I wrote a book report about David Copperfield for my father, and I read that book. It was really shocking to me.
It amazed me that you were reading David Copperfield at that age. So obviously you found those papers, but you also obviously had your journals and the things that you've kept over the years as you got older and stuff like that. So as you were writing this book, how did it feel to go back into them?
Yeah, not good. So a lot of these journals are about books and just sort of writing, like trying to learn to write and describing things. Also, a lot of them are just full of that awful angst that you go through in high school, art school. I mean, all the misery of it. So. Yeah, there was a lot of that whining and trying to figure out relationships. You know, people say to me, oh, this is such a personal book, and it certainly is, but there's so much that's not in there. And that's all in the journals.
Well, that was actually something I was going to ask you about, because there are some very personal components to this book, which is what I think really ties it together, because you are telling some very painful, personal, difficult things in your life that the books helped you get through or helped shape your reaction to. And so as you were doing this, and you mentioned earlier that it was, you know, something that the editors kind of pushed back and wanted a little bit more of, how did you make the decisions about what to include and what not to include from your life? Because it's also very clear that you keep some things out.
Oh, yes. Well, thank you for that. Someone, I saw something online where someone said, well, you know, apparently she just didn't really have relationships. Like, yeah, no, that was not true. So I left out, you know, whenever I'd sort of mention someone else, me and my editor would just think, eh, we don't have time to really explain all that. Mm-hmm. And you know, I just didn't really want to go there. I really, really wanted to try and focus on the books and the things that books helped me with, and also other experiences that sort of shaped my sensibility. So I did, I left out all that other stuff. And I didn't write that much. I wrote very little about my family. And just
some very important parts. But I have to say that, you know, there was a moment in the book where I'm very curious, as you are looking for your cat. And you very clearly are saying, we are looking for the cat, but I don't know who else is looking for the cat.
Yes.
And so I actually
missed that one.
It's very interesting that as you read a book like this, that, you know, there are these very personal and private and painful things that you bring up, and some that are somewhat maybe embarrassing to someone if they're talking about their past, and that you've carefully chosen things to leave out. And that's a part of the process of writing, is the author in a work of fiction or in anything else always has to decide what details to put in and what to leave out. And I think that it's really fun, because obviously what you're talking about are books, but you're also talking about your life and how they're intertwined. So I actually find it very enjoyable to feel that tension between what you're revealing and then what is holding back.
Oh, that's great to hear.
Now, on that note, I'm going to ask you about a couple of the more interesting personal tidbits that came up that I wanted to, you know, you can explain what's in the book, or you can explain even in more detail. But I'm going to start with your life of crime and the irony of what happened, the book that led to your end of your life of crime.
Yes. So I had to think about this story. But so I explain in the book, I was sort of a wild child, with no excuse. I mean, I came from a middle-class family. I was not hungry. I was well cared for, but I was a really good shoplifter. And it was just a thing. I don't know what authority I thought I was pushing back against, but and I grew up in a small river city in the Hudson Valley. Nobody there could really afford to have teenagers stealing things. I wasn't the only one, I will say. And I was very selective. So I was in high school, and I was on a Russian author reading kick, and I was, Dostoevsky was my target, and I went to this little store, this little shop on Main Street, and they had a copy of The Idiot, which I thought I was going to steal, but as I was leaving, the shopkeeper came up and stopped me and said, you know, are you going to pay for that? And I was deeply mortified, and I took the book out of wherever I had concealed it. And I said to her, who's the idiot? And that was the last thing I ever stole. And I have that book. And this is one of the odd things about memories. I still have that paperback. I don't know why I have it. I can't remember. I was so mortified and angry at myself. Like, my memory just fogs over. I don't know if I fished out the money and paid for it. If she gave it to me, I kind of think I must have paid for it. But I ended up with it, so I can never, so I always remember that. But she reluctantly laughed when I said that. So.
Well, and I bring that one up especially because I too had my period of shoplifting.
See
and
that?
And I too was, you know,
did you get
busted?
Busted.
And that ended my period of shoplifting. But I do, I understand the, you're railing against something
for no apparent reason.
No need, no apparent reason, but you feel this compulsion at a certain age, which we were probably around the same age when we were doing those things. So I actually, and that goes to the notion of how, you know, books were important to me, books were important to you, and I feel like, you know, that, but there's still also the notion of trying to fit in or feeling like, how do you deal with the world around you?
Yeah,
and you do stupid things.
You do stupid things, really stupid things.
I thought that that was funny.
This is so funny.
And so I also wanted to know, you know, so probably one of the biggest things about this, and I knew that you had studied art, but, you know, you are someone who at a very young age starts reading heavily. You're obviously doing book reports at a young age for your father.
For my measly allowance.
You're stealing books. And then you have a high school period that is rough in the beginning, and then you find a better place, which is all very interesting. But then you go to art school in, you're growing up in Poughkeepsie, New York, and now you suddenly decide to go to Kansas City, Missouri, to art school to study really sculpture and things of that nature. I know your mom was an artist. What was the driving force for someone who was so into reading? I would think the easy choice would be, oh, I'm going to go be an English major or communications or anything. But you went hardcore art.
Yes. Such a perverse person. I hated school, frankly. I mean, I was a huge reader, tremendous reader, wanted to write, was bored to tears and fury in school. Just, I mean, I did all right, but I had some bad years where I just stopped going. A little juvenile delinquent here. And I was really, I just wanted to make things. Like, I just thought about that. I think I just needed to be more occupied. I needed to be physically involved in something creative. And my mother was an artist. Our home was full of her art and her friend's art. It was also a home where, you know, we liked to make things. Everyone cooked and baked. And, you know, I was just really interested in, you know, everything from crochet to drawing to painting. My father built things. I liked tools and I liked to build things. So I had no interest in going to college at all. My parents did not go to college. They grew up in the Bronx, very poor. They had really horrible childhoods. So they had all these aspirations for their very difficult daughters. So I mean, I was always going to go to college, but I chose art school instead, and they were surprised, but supportive as much as they could be. So it was really just sort of a rebelliousness. I figured I could always read and write. I mean, no one was going to stop me from that. But I wanted to learn more about art and spend more time in that visual realm and, you know, just learn how to make things and just feel like a whole person in that way. And it's a great education.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do. I think it's amazing that you went that route and that you kept on reading. And at one point you talk about, I think it's, you know, working with Loom and I don't know, if you can talk a little bit about the notion of how you saw the loom in relationship to text.
Yes.
Can you explain that a little bit?
My art career was really a funny thing because I was really became enamored of textiles and weaving and fabric. I left public school and went to a private day school, which was great. It was a really open kind of school. And there was a woman there who was running a weaving workshop because she was a weaver. And this just spoke to me in so many ways. And in the book, I talk a lot about how you spin a tale and you tell a yarn and all this kind of stuff. So weaving that sort of linear building of images out of lines always seemed a lot like text to me. It seemed a lot like reading. So I loved that. And I spent a couple of years doing that. And then when I went to art school, I chose, you know, New Yorkers don't know anything about the Midwest. I had no idea where I was going. I thought I was going to Kansas. And I picked that art school. It was very small and very progressive, and they had a fiber arts department, I thought. But when I went there, it had disappeared. They did not have one. So that was one of many sort of odd paths. So I ended up in the sculpture department. But over the years, and you know, I realized this later, everything I did sort of drifted back to two dimensions. I built things out of stone. I built things out of wood. I used fabrics. And then I started doing drawings and watercolors, and everything just got very linear, and I ended up back writing and reading. And so it's kind of funny.
I'm going to ask your third thing. So you obviously we talked about your life of crime. We talked about a little bit about art school in that period in Kansas. Then in part of your time here, before obviously you get to ALA and things like that, can you tell us a little bit about the bookstore that you drove out of business?
Oh, this is such a funny story. So, my first job in Chicago was at the Newberry Library.
Right.
I love the Newberry, but they paid so poorly, I could really not live on that salary, even though I was living very simply. So I got a second job at a little bookstore. I swear it existed. It was at Diversity and Clark. It was called the Book Market. It was tiny. It stayed afloat by selling Playboy, you know, a bunch of smutty magazines in the dark corner. And there were books. I read a lot of the books. But mainly it was these magazines, and I was often there alone at night, so it was a little dicey. And I kept complaining to the manager, and she kept complaining to whoever was running the corporate office. And finally they agreed they were going to get rid of these magazines, it could just be a bookstore, and it shortly went out of business.
And I found that very, very funny, having worked in bookstores.
Yes.
In the book, and this, like in that particular period, there's an example of when you're talking about the bookstore and everything. You talk about, you know, Charles Levy and the distributor. At other parts of the book, when you talk about a library that you went to, you take the time to talk about who that library is named after and the history of that person. So instead of just mentioning a library, you also give me the history of the family whose name is on the building and why they were so rich or why they were giving money. And I'm kind of curious, as you go down those rabbit holes, it reminds me of obviously when we're reading and we want to go look something up and we're like, oh, what is this? And I need to, I'm kind of curious how you chose to make those side journeys that happen in the book. Like what was the driving force for some of that?
Yeah, I think, you know, I love research. I love research. I could just do that all the time. And, you know, I would just get curious, you know, like my hometown library, I'm like, so who were these people? And I find all that interesting. Plus, you know, I was a reluctant memoirist. I was sort of more interested in telling other people's stories. So I tell the story about the family that started the public library. I talk about how there's a road in my hometown that was Seaman Road, but of course, it was certainly not us. Who was it? So I tell that story. So to me, that's just fun and interesting. And I like reading books that do that, that take you on these little tangents. A lot of those got cut out, but the ones that stayed, I thought had a purpose. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just like context. You know, I like to know the background of things. So it was fun. Yeah. So I try not to overdo it. But
No, I think it's very fun to think about, you know, like, you know, as somebody again worked in a bookstore in Chicago, I know who Levy was.
That's so funny.
And how important they were. And
did you know about the contest when they won the wagon?
And, no, I didn't know
I
any
didn't
of
either,
that. So,
right?
You know, I knew who this company was, and they distributed all the magazines and everything that you got at your bookstore. They were the big distributor in the area. And so I had no idea. And then Donna spoke, just told me the whole story of how this guy won a wagon
and a
horse. And that's what started his business. It's actually absolutely fascinating. I love it. We talked a little bit about like the weaving and how you kind of got back to two dimensions. You also talk about reading as something that you do all the time, even when there's not text. You talk about like being in a boat and looking at the houses on a lake and getting a sense of reading that space. Can you talk a little bit about how reading is everywhere in everything that you do?
Yes, it's such a habit of mine that, you know, I think of reading as just attention. You're like hyper attentive to things and very receptive, and you know, you're interested in the details. And you know, I just this particular incident, I just found myself, I was just, you know, we were on a little lake in Wisconsin, it wasn't that interesting, we're in a little boat, and I'm like scrutinizing everything with this great intent, and I'm supposed to be relaxing. I mean, I was relaxing, this is how I relax. And I thought, wow, I'm like totally reading this landscape, I'm reading every one of these buildings, I'm like, how old is this building, and how was that made, and that window looks odd, and the, you know, what that's a, that door is angled weird, you know, every little thing just. And I'm like, oh, it's like word by word, you know, everything you're looking at, leaf by leaf, house by house, reading. And that, you know, you tell yourself stories. And, you know, you're always narrating in your head one way or another. So I'm like narrating this place to myself. And then, and really like happy. I mean, this is like the way I pay attention. And I think that whole idea of being attentive and interested, curious and receptive is being mindful. It's a good way to live. And, you know, it just opens you to so many experiences and realities, other people and other creatures and just our whole universe.
And I think that's, you know, an amazing part of this is you're working through all of these different books that have had such an impact on you and how in different periods of your life you're reading different things and are sucked into, you know, whether it's nature writing or, you know, about war and proliferation, or whether it's, you know, Dostoevsky or different periods. So it's really interesting to see how the different points in your life are shaped by the books and your attentiveness to the idea of reading. But obviously, you're also a writer. You've been journaling throughout your life, and then you become someone who writes for a living. And while this isn't necessarily a deep part of the book, you take on your job at the American Library Association as an editorial assistant, and you right away start freelancing some of the reviews that you were doing. So it was additional work that you could do because you were poor, and you would do anything, and it was a great opportunity. So how did making that shift from being so much about writing to reading to being more about also writing as a profession, how did that affect you?
Oh, well, it was really exciting. I mean, I could hardly believe it. I lacked confidence to a serious degree. And when people say something to me about my career being professional, I'm always like, oh, I guess, because my impetus was to feed my habit. I mean, all I thought about was, I just want to be able to read, and I want books in my life, and how can I do that? And I thought, well, you know, working in publishing and also having this arts background. I mean, originally, I could have been a production editor too, mm-hmm. but my skills really were more in the language. So yeah, I ended up at ALA, which has a big publishing department. They had a magazine called Booklist, which I just thought was my destiny, having kept so many booklists in my life. And, you know, writing those reviews, I wrote tons, of course, in grad school, and I think I had something published in school magazines. I'm sure I did. But, you know, this was like a national book review magazine, and, you know, to have a byline in there and be trusted to review a book, and it was just thrilling, and it just seemed like a big step up, and it just was very natural. It came very readily to me. I mean, it's hard, and mm-hmm. These are very concise reviews, so it's very demanding, had to distill everything down. So it was a big learning experience, but it felt really good. And, you know, once I was on the staff and became an editor, which I never really had thought much about, but got really curious about. And, you know, that really is very different than reading and writing, but it combines both, and mm-hmm. it's really challenging. So all that is just so occupying. It's just endlessly fascinating. And I've been doing it a long time, and it's never easy, and it's never the same. So it's a gift.
And you mentioned obviously that, especially as you became an editor, and now editor in chief, you know, you obviously had so much work to do during the day that then the reading of the things you're going to review happened at night and out and on the train and everywhere else. So do you have any notion of how many reviews you would do in a year? Many books you would read in a year?
Well, it's, I call these questions the freak of nature questions. Like, how could she read and write so much? I don't know. I mean, I don't review as much as I used to, which is fine. But I would guess, you know, thousands of reviews over my
entire
time.
Career. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And along with that, as you progressed, obviously you had the opportunity to, after you're writing and that, now you get to start interviewing people. You know, you're asked to be the person who sits here in this chair and talks to the writer. You've done it here many times. Mm-hmm. You do it everywhere around the city. People are reliant on you as probably the go-to person to interview a writer. So I guess my question is, as you've done that over the years, you know, how has that impacted you where you got the chance to know writers who you thought of only as somebody you read, and now they're people that you know? How does that shift?
Oh, yeah, that was amazing. It's nerve-wracking. I think my very first interview was for Booklist. It was Amy Tan. Oh. And I was terrified. And Booklist hadn't done a lot of interviews. This was sort of a new thing. And I met her at, I think it was the Palmer House, actually. And she was really nice. And I realized, I'm like, oh, writers like to talk. You know, writers are storytellers. They're fun to talk to. It's not, I mean, you have to prepare. Like mm-hmm. The prep work is intense, as yep. you've done. And I thank you for that. But once you're there with a writer, I mean, not always, but usually they really love to talk and they speak beautifully. And it became something I just loved. It was really exciting. So I'd be exhausted, all the prep work, a nervous wreck. Then the conversation would begin and I'd be like, oh, this is great.
And the and along those lines, just to pick one, you mentioned in the book, and again, as you mentioned, the book really covers your from being very young chronologically to really where you wound up at Booklist, and then as kind of a that's who you became, and so that's kind of where the book ends. But you take, as you mentioned, you know, this is a river of books, so you take some little tributaries, and sometimes you jump forward in time and give us a little more information. And so one that kind of stood out to me is obviously you came to Chicago and read Studs Terkel to understand the city, but then you got to know Studs Terkel and through a host of ways. And so I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about like having that relationship grow and what that meant.
Yeah, you know, most of the writers I interview, there's not like a relationship. In fact, I've had writers say something to me like, oh, this is really great, but you know, I don't want to stay in touch. I have friends. I need people to write about my work. Meaning, you know, if you get to know someone, you can't review them. But Studs was a whole different thing. Of course, mm-hmm. he was beyond being reviewed by the likes of me. And I would just run into Studs as many, you know, many Chicagoans do. And we would just talk books. And he had some like photographic memory or something. And I would ask him about an author, a book. I said, did you ever review so-and-so? And he's like, oh, yeah, yeah. I said, oh, I really like, you know, this particular book. We were talking about Grapes of Wrath. I remember vividly. It was that's a party. I mean, it's noisy. There's all this going on. And Studs just starts reciting like the opening pages from memory. And I'm just like, oh, my God. And sometimes when other writers would come to town, I would, you know, end up going to dinner with them. And Studs was losing his hearing. Now, here's the great listener, the oral historian, who gathered people's stories for decades, who was on radio for 45, 50 years, and was going deaf. So that was kind of sad. So sometimes I would kind of be there to be like an interpreter, you know, like sort of sit between him and someone and go, oh, this and this. But I noticed, and I, you know, did a lot of events with Studs too. I had the great honor of, when I was on the National Book Critics Circle board, I tell this story where there's a Lifetime Achievement Award. And, you know, Studs Terkel in certain circles was not considered a writer or like a literary person. He was like some guy on the street or something. Mm-hmm. And we had huge fights about this, legendary fights at the NBCC. And we prevailed, called Studs to tell him. He just started laughing, really cracking up. And finally, after he stopped, took a breath, and he said to me, Donna, how did you convince those New York Mandarins to do this? Like he knew. He always knew. And as he got, you know, sort of accepted that his hearing was pretty much shot, I think he developed some sort of sixth sense. I mean, I was on a panel with him once. There was no way that he could hear what was going on. And I was like writing little notes, and he kept going like this to me. Like, and then he would just jump in. It's almost like he'd had so many conversations in his life that he could just with a couple of cues, kind of follow along, and he'd step in and do this. And he also managed to talk to me on the phone, which was really mysterious. Mm. He had an assistant, Juan, who would call me, and he goes, well, Studs wants to talk to you. I'm like, oh, do you need me to come over? I'm like, how is he going to talk to me? He goes, well, he says he can hear you on the phone. So I don't know what that was about. It was a little paranormal, but what a great guy.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's absolutely fascinating. You know, as I mentioned, you know, I think the book is wonderful. You do stop at a certain point, and so one of the things that you don't talk about is your time with us.
Right.
And I mean, you know, the museum. For those who are unaware, you know, we opened in May of 2017, but the conception of the idea of the museum goes back to 2010, 2011. In the process of putting the museum together, there were a group of people that were pulled together to be kind of the content leaders. They were people like Donna, there's Reg Gibbons from Northwestern University, there's Max, and there's a whole host of folks and Poet Laureate of the US and others who were involved in these conversations about what should be in the museum, who should be covered, what themes should be looked at, and things of that nature. And you were a part of that process. Can you talk a little bit about what that was like and what you enjoyed about it?
Oh, that was so much fun. I mean, what is a writer's museum? What's going to be in it? It's not a library. It's not a museum of artifacts necessarily. So, you know, it's a museum of ideas and language and thought and writers' lives. So it was difficult. And plus, we didn't know, you know, how much funding we were going to get. I mean, this was such a quixotic idea, really. And we started out really blue skying. Scott's here. He was on the design team. And you would provide us with these incredible images to look at. So we would have these long, long meetings. We went to Boston, where Amaze Designs is. We went to Washington, D.C., because Malcolm was there. We met in Chicago all the time. And we would have these just long conversations trying to envision a space that would be about books and what would be in there, how many writers could we talk about. So we had to come up with criteria and like limitations, like, you know, the wall of writers back there, you would believe the fights over the over those 100 writers. It was so difficult. And you know, that it would end, it would only be writers who were no longer living in as people but as books. So those conversations were really inspiring, and I was loved it because I just, you know, my passion aside from books is art, so I love museums. I never miss a chance to go to a museum, and I have very strong opinions about museums. So it, it felt very natural for me to be part of that discussion. And it was great. I mean, we had so many different perspectives, and it took years and years. And meanwhile, Malcolm and Werner and the board are trying to raise money. So it was, and there were times when we just didn't know if it was ever going to happen.
And I, you know, I know I came in toward the end of a lot of that content work, and you know, obviously it was something that we could not have done this without you and the others who really put in that time. I know that, like, the 100 authors that you mentioned on that timeline, that I think originally there was a list of almost 300.
Oh, yes.
And then the real fights were who you had to take off.
Who you had to take off. And the other awesome thing is we wrote, you know, there's when you turn the triangle things, there's little pieces that we actually ended up writing. To be writing to be in a museum was really exciting. And Scott and his group came up with all these sort of technical ways to talk about, you know, like the map and the front. I mean, these are all things, like we would have these kind of ideas, like, it would be so cool to have a map. And we'd be like, well, yeah, a map. And then we're like, oh, well, here's what you can do with a map. And, you know, all the video and the different ways to search for things. So it was just a great learning experience altogether.
Well, and it's interesting to me, again, having known you for so long as the as a book person, to then see that visual background and how clear it was that, you know, you have a sense of space, that you have a sense of, you know, of color and vision and that kind of thing. So obviously doing a project like this was probably just perfect for you in that time. And then obviously we've been very fortunate because you've been so kind with your time to sit in this chair and interview so many writers. If you're on our YouTube page and you scroll through, the most commonly featured person will be Donna Seaman. I'm pretty sure that you would get the highest count. I thought maybe we could ask the audience if they might have any questions. While they're thinking of their questions, and there might be questions online, I'm going to ask you kind of just one more right now, which is, obviously, you've written other books, you've written this book. Is there another project on its way?
Oh, thank you. Well, I hope so, yes. You know, when I wrote Identity Unknown, people that didn't really know me, knew me as a book person, were really confused. They would keep saying to me, oh, you're writing about writers. I'm like, no, this book's about artists. So now, you know, I love writing profiles. I really like writing about other people more than myself. So there are a lot of overlooked book people, book review editors and other kinds of editors, and just forgotten writers. So I have a, like kind of a little list of people I'm interested in. I'd like to do some more profiles. And some of the things that got cut out of this book, including we were talking about a professor we both knew. So I'd like to do some more research on him. And so that kind of project I'm hoping to do.
So this has led to some future thoughts.
Yes, definitely.
That's awesome.
Yes, thank you.
Are there questions in the audience?
I have two questions. First, what was the going rate for a book report from your dad?
Oh, man, I think it was like 50 cents or something.
Sweet.
Yeah.
And as a grown-up, what is your process for doing a review, writing a review?
My process for writing a review? Well, the most important thing is the reading. So I read, you know, really attentively, carefully, take a lot of notes, look up a lot of things. And, you know, while I'm reading, I'm just trying to picture. Writing bookless reviews in particular, they're just so short. So, you know, I get it. I think everything's interesting. I get pulled all over the place, but I have to keep reminding myself to just try and, you know, what's the center of this? Like, you know, if you can only write about so much, so little, what is that going to be? So so throughout the book, I'm sort of really interested in all the details and all the fine points, but I'm also trying to see the larger picture and what is its shape. And then the writing, you know, just like with this book, I always write probably twice as much as I can use and then go back. I mean, revision is just the key to it all, going back over it and writing it again and taking things out. And sometimes, and editing too, I see this, where reviewers have written a really interesting review, but it's almost like they're looking in a little keyhole and we're not seeing more of what we need to see, and you need to shift it back over and start again. So it's very much, you know, here's the visual side of me looking at this. It's very much about shaping a whole and making sure that it's encompassing as much of the book as you can.
Hi, I've really enjoyed. I'm wondering about how you interact with memory and remembering when you're interacting with so many texts all the time. And yeah, what's memory like for you, I guess?
That's a great question. Thank you. Yeah, it was really interesting working on this. The things that I thought I remembered, and in some cases, they were not accurate. The book sort of begins with a mis-memory of a book. I pictured it in the myths I told myself over the years in a certain way, but when I finally found the book, it was very different. Having said that, though, a lot of other things just remain really sharp in my mind. And certain books, I really remember them very clearly, and others I don't. So I think it's, you know, what strikes a chord with you, what really marks you deeply in some way, those memories stay with you. I did a lot of rereading when I worked on this book, and which was really interesting, because in a couple of cases, I'm like, oh God, this is not what I thought this was at all. Or conversely, like, oh yes, no wonder this impressed me back at that age. I still need to know this. I still need to feel this. So it's an ongoing process. Memory is very slippery and, you know, not terrifically reliable. But so it's an interesting contrast between what gets sort of hazy and what stays sharp.
So in your professional life, a lot of reviewing kind of gets down to making a sculpture that represents the book, distilling into a recognizable form. Have you thought about going the other direction and doing deep dive book reviews, and even a book that links deep dive book reviews?
You know, back in the day when there were Sunday book sections, a number of them, I did write long reviews. I mean, you could write 2,000, 3,000 word reviews. They were heaven. I loved them. My motto at Booklist was, I have more to say. So I sought out places where I could write longer reviews. I used to write for a publication called The Hungry Mind Review, wrote page long, then multiple book reviews, you know, essays. So I've done that, and it is a real pleasure. It's been a really long time. I haven't done that in a long time. It was funny, when I was working on this book, I found that I didn't want to do that. That I wanted this to be more of a narrative and more about the impact of books and the emotional response to books. You know, I think part of it's also too that I write so many reviews, I kind of want to write something else in my own time. But I'm looking forward to writing about writers. And when I wrote about artists, I spent a lot of time writing about their art. So I would spend time writing about their work in more depth.
You've talked about your process as bringing things down to less. How has the digital world changed your process? Do you write by hand first and then on the computer? How does that work for you?
Oh, thank you. I take notes by hand, and I write a lot of sort of drafts by hand. I think better with pen and paper. I think, you know, sometimes I'm like really crushed for time, and I'll be like, I'm just going to take notes on the computer. And it just never works as well for me somehow. You know, since COVID, we've gone digital and reading, and I adjusted to that more readily than I expected. I was, you know, sort of reluctant and felt that that wasn't going to be good for me. I'm sort of used to the geography of an actual book, where I can like picture the corner, you know, the quadrant of the page where things are. But I'm very pragmatic, and I just did it. And then I found too that I can boost up the font, so I don't have to wear glasses when I read, and I kind of like that. And I so much more care about the book than the vessel that I adjusted to it. It doesn't mean that I don't acquire books all the time and that my house isn't bursting with physical books, but the digital aspect has been helpful in a lot of ways. And I like writing on a computer. You know, I remember battling with typewriters and their hard work, right? So I appreciate all those things, but and like for this book, I filled a lot of did a lot of handwriting first and then went back. But for revision, there's nothing like revising online. It's clean, and I have horrible handwriting too, so I can really frustrate myself that way. So it's a real blend.
You write a lot about the books that you read, but you also read Chicago in this book. And this sentence I just thought was startling. People burbled up from the subways, poured down from the L, pushed into buses, and elbowed their way out, jousting with umbrellas and hunched in the knifing wind, spinning litter, blowing grit, and diving pigeons. I mean, it was like, you know, you were talking about all these iconic Chicago writers writing and reading Chicago, and you're doing, I was like, this is like my favorite sentence.
Oh.
This is beautiful.
Thank you so much. It's fun to write about Chicago.
But I think it's interesting, you know, I am kind of curious, you know, in looking at this, you know, you talk about getting to Chicago as a stop on your way back to New York,
yeah.
Which obviously did not work. And you know, that sentence and some of the other things you talk about the city and the places that you lived, and apparently we lived next to each other.
Yes, amazing.
She mentioned a place in the book, and I'm like, when did you live there? And oh yeah, we were neighbors. So I'm kind of curious if, you know, what do you think held you?
Well, I would say a few things. I married a guy from Wisconsin, mm-hmm. who lives here, and Booklist when I started working there. You know, there's very few jobs for book fanatics.
Right.
Very few jobs. And I looked at other jobs, and I thought about other jobs. And because, you know, it's not easy. Magazine work is stressful. It's not easy. And, you know, every job's challenging. But I just, there was, you know, the alternatives just didn't appeal to me. And I always meant to go back to New York, but everyone I knew in New York was living in a closet. And even at my poorest, I had the whole first floor of a three flat. So I don't know. Again, my practical side. And I just made great friends here. Some people here tonight I've known forever. So it became my home for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, it just did.
I also, I don't know if you want to read this or not. You basically,
sure.
It's what I hope for in books.
Oh.
You have these dividers.
Yeah, what
and,
page is that?
So it starts on 59 and goes on to 60 and 61. And I bring it up because it's a dividing point where you've been talking and then you step away from the memoir and you just kind of give us this list, and you're good at lists. But what I found about this was, and I don't know how much you revised this, but I think it's a nice stopping point for us tonight. But I would love to hear it, only because when I read it probably four times, because it felt like a poem to me. And I don't know that you created it in that way, but it sure felt like it.
Oh, thank you for saying that. I've tried to write poetry. I am not a poet. There are lists in this book. I thought of these as sort of like soundings, like a riverboat captain takes soundings of the depths of the river. And I, at some point, you know, my editor was talking to me about, you know, well, what do you look for in books? And maybe you need to write about that. And I was like, maybe. And so I wrote this list, and I sort of worked on it some more, and I thinking it was going to lead to something else. And then I kept looking at it going, I'm just going to keep this list. So, thank you. This list is what I hope for in books. Arresting voices, exacting descriptions, the unexpected, the confluence of inner and outer worlds, interconnections, intimate and cosmic, nature illuminated on scales minute and monumental, emotions exactingly conveyed, new perspectives, old stories retold with fresh insights, startling stories that illuminate the stamp of the past on the present on the future, the pursuit of social justice, the wonders of science, history true and holistic, the big picture, a microcosm, metaphors and similes of startling inventiveness and aptness, the fusion of the actual and the made up, crisp, succinct sentences, long, riverine, meandering, nuanced, disconcerting, funny, gorgeous, lyrical, elevating, burrowing, spiraling, complex, erotic, shimmering, percussive, many-faceted, suspenseful, unnerving, dizzying, breathtaking sentences. Words as smooth from use as pebbles on a beach, words as piercing as thorns. Unfamiliar words that send you to the dictionary. Love, doubt, wit, spiritual questioning, irreverence, awe, philosophical debates, satire, the nexus of body and mind, the extension of possibility, suspense, irony, empathy, complexity, perplexity, hilarity, elucidation, resonance, musicality, artistry, food for thought, soul food.
So.
Thank you.
Thank
you.
I thought that would be a wonderful place for us to stop. And I want to thank you, Donna. And if we can all thank Donna just again.
Thank you.
For everything you've done for this museum, for everything you've done for the literary community around the world and in this city, and for this wonderful book. So thank you all for being here, and thank you, Donna.
Thank you, Carrie, for such a wonderful conversation. Really sucks. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode from the American Writers Museum Podcast Network. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.